Okay. Good evening, everybody. It's been a long time. I was in Asia for some weeks. Then I got the super flu. And then last week I was at a monastic conference. But today, causes and conditions came together and we can continue with the teachings. So we've been going through the text on the Four Foundations for Establishments of Mindfulness by Gyalachukyi Gyaltsen. And so we've so far talked about the observed objects, what they are, the body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. And now we're on the second heading called the manner of meditation. And so we talked about the common manner of meditation, how all these things are impermanent in the nature of dukkha or unsatisfactory, how they are foul, no, how they're empty and how they're selfless. Okay? And so now we're talking about their specific characteristics, and so which is the uncommon manner of meditation. And so we are... No, I'm sorry. We're still talking about the common manner, but we're talking about their specific characteristics, okay? And so we're talking about how the body is by nature foul, okay? So this is a meditation that is a real button pusher, especially in American culture where we are so hooked on our bodies. And the body is beautiful and the most happiness I can ever get is sense pleasure, and so the purpose of my life is to have as much sense pleasure as possible with this body. Okay, and then along comes the Buddha and says, well, check up and look at your body, and is it really as attractive as you think it is? And check up the bodies of other people that you lust after and see if there's really anything there to lust after, anything there to be attached to. And so at the last teaching, we were talking about thinking of our body as the precursor of a corpse, remember? And so we meditated on the color of the corpse, because that, you know, opposes our attachment to the color of somebody's body or to our own body. We meditated on the shape, imagining it getting chopped up to counteract our attachment to the shape of the body. We meditated on the body being eaten up by maggots, the corpse being eaten up by maggots, because it counteracts our attachment to the tactile sensation of the body. And, wait a minute, did I get that right? Let me check. Yeah, maggots. Yeah, destroyed that. Okay, and then to to combat our attachment to the enjoyment of the body, we imagine the corpse as being completely immobile. Okay, so there's some questions somebody sent in after that teaching, yeah, that I imagine a few people might have had. Okay, so somebody says, whose body as a corpse am I supposed to meditate on? My own? I tried that, and it seemed like I had to create a little scenario where I died and was not found by anyone for a while in order to think of your body as a corpse. Okay, so, yeah, if you do this for your own body, you also do it regarding the bodies of other people, especially those who you're sexually attracted to. Okay, if you're doing it on your own, you know, I mean, if that's what it takes to imagine your body as a corpse, is to think you die and then the body was sitting there rotting before you came along and analyzed it, you can do that. Or you can, you know, just realize that this body is the cause of the corpse and go from, you know, this moment to the moment when it's a corpse, you know, fast forward, and then just look at the color, shape, tactile sensations, and enjoyment that is possible to get from a corpse. Okay. And so, likewise, I said you can do this for the body of somebody that you're sexually attracted to. I taught this in Singapore many years ago to college students, and one young man came up and he said, "That makes me not want to have sex." And I said, "Well, that's kind of the purpose of this, you know?" Yeah. Okay. And then the person had another thing, another question. "I don't have a romantic or sexual partner, nor am I interested in that, so I don't know who else's body I would meditate on." Well, we always say, yeah, I'm not interested in that. Well, that's because nobody's walked in front of us right now. But, you know, we haven't abandoned lust and desire, and as you know, somebody walks in front, our mind gets attracted, and there we go, and it doesn't matter how old you are. Yeah. I mean, it's worse when you're young and your hormones are bonkers, but it also happens when you're old. Okay, the next question, "Or do I just meditate on a generic corpse?" It's better if you meditate on your body or some specific person's body, okay? So that you really, it's personal, it's more powerful that way, okay? And is the purpose of this meditation to cut off attraction to others' bodies and my own? Yes. So in terms of others' bodies, we cut off the, you know, the lust and the attachment that is craving for others' bodies. And this is, you know, many people have told me in their meditation, it can be very, very difficult. You know, even you're in a retreat setting, you know, there's somebody that walks by that you're attracted to, and you want to meditate, and your mind's daydreaming about that person. So this meditation is very good for cutting that off, you know, and helping you return to your object of meditation. But also it's very helpful if you use your own body because, you know, why do we keep taking bodies? You know, in the three principal aspects of the path, we talk about embodied beings. You know, that's a very powerful term, embodied beings. You know, we take this body under the power of ignorance and afflictions and karma, and then we're bound to it. Yeah, we're bound to it. And so the craving mind desires pleasure from it, then we're completely distracted by making this body comfortable, by making it attractive, by doing this, that, and the other thing to protect it, and so on. Okay? So, and then especially at the time of death, when we have to separate from this body, you know, we have to separate from friends and relatives and possessions, but we haven't been with them our whole life. Our body we've been with 24/7, and we have to separate from it, and it's been the basis of so much of our identity. And the mind goes nuts. You know, who am I going to be if I don't have this body? And so there's incredible attachment that arises, and then that makes karma, you know, ripen and throws us into the next body. Okay, so meditating on, you know, that our own body is foul, then helps us lose interest in taking another one. I mean, why do you want another one? So you can do the whole thing all over again that we've done with this one? We haven't had enough? You know, from beginningless time, we haven't had enough? We always need more, you know, pleasure from our body? So, you know, that attitude is what keeps us taking one rebirth after another. It's involved in that ignorance. Okay, so, you know, if we can see our own body is, you know, nothing, there's nothing there to be attached to, then when we die, if we remember that, then, oh yeah, this body is just a bunch of atoms and molecules, and it's kind of gucky, you know. I'm not going to, you know, cling on to this thing because the insides of it are completely rotten. So then you let go of the attachment to the body, and that really facilitates the death process and helps you to concentrate, you know, helps us concentrate when we're dying on something worthwhile, keeping our mind in a virtuous state. Okay? So that was one meditation. Now, there's another meditation that's called The General Antidote to Desire is Meditating on a Skeleton. Okay, so first we meditated on the body as a corpse, now as a skeleton. Okay, so these are ways for a beginner to meditate as well as for an advanced bodhisattva to meditate. Okay, and the thing is, with the skeleton, we have the skeleton in us right now. The corpse, you know, we have the seed of the corpse right now, but the skeleton's already there. Okay, and so this meditation on the skeleton acts as an opponent to all, to attachment to all four characteristics of the body. Okay, so to the color, the shape, the tactile sensation, and then the enjoyment from it. So there's three steps to the meditation on the body of the skeleton. And in the teachings I've received on this, the last two steps I've heard in slightly different ways. So I'll describe both of them because I think both of them are quite helpful when you meditate on them. The first one is pretty much the same. So here, you know, you focus on your body, you're sitting here, and you focus on the center of your brow, and you imagine that there's like a hole here that goes down to the bone. Okay? And then, and it's the hole is the size of the tip of your thumb. It's there. Okay? And then the hole gets bigger, okay? So you still have the hole's in the flesh, so you can see the bone. Then as the hole gets bigger, the flesh starts to fall away, okay? So you have your outside skin and everything and the muscles on the outside, and then as you go down through your body, you know, all the flesh is falling away, all the muscles are falling away, all your internal organs are falling away. You just imagine them dissolving. And so that at the end, all your flesh, tissue, everything else is gone, and there's just your skeleton there, okay? And all the bones are exposed. Okay, you got it? Can you think of it even now with your eyes open? I mean, here's the skeleton sitting cross-legged, isn't there? Yeah? You just take away all the tissue and see the skeleton that's sitting cross-legged there. And then you imagine that the skeleton gets larger and it keeps growing. This is like a Disney movie, okay? You know, so your skeleton gets larger and it grows and then it fills this room. So, you know, this whole room becomes filled with our skeleton. And then it grows larger and it becomes, you know, the side, it fills the whole valley up to the top of the mountains around us. And then it keeps getting larger and larger and larger till it reaches the ocean. Then it goes beyond the ocean. It's, you know, becomes the size of the earth, then the size of the solar system. And then we imagine that all of space is filled with the skeleton of our body. In other words, all of space is filled with bones. That's all there is bones. And it's our bones. Got it? Okay. Does this change how you think of your body? I'm looking at your facial expressions, and I think it does. Yeah? It seems initially rather horrific, but it's actually what the body is, isn't it? It's a bunch of, it's bones, if we take away all the other stuff that's clung onto it. And when you look around, we see all these people, and they're all dressed up in their fancy schmancy clothes and their aftershave and their perfume. But actually, what's walking down the street are a bunch of bones, a bunch of skeletons. You know, if it were Halloween time, you would think this is quite amusing. Yeah, but this is true, isn't it? So your skeleton gets so enormous. And you know, and then you just stay single-pointed on that image of, you know, the all of space being filled with bones, you know, the bones of your skeleton. And then after a while, then the skeleton starts getting smaller again, okay, and it comes back down to normal size, how you are right now. And, yeah, and at that point, it's the normal size skeleton. And then you just imagine, you know, there you are again, not anymore a skeleton. You're what looks like not a skeleton again. Okay? So this is the first step for the beginner to do this. Okay? When you get good at doing that, okay, now I'm going to describe step two and step three in one way that they're taught, and then I'll go through and describe them in the other way I heard them. Okay, step two, one way, is you begin in the same way with the whole, and it's expanding, and it becomes a skeleton, and all your tissue is just falls away and disappears, and the skeleton gets enormous and fills the universe, okay? And then you develop your concentration on that. And when you do that, your mind becomes so calm. I tell you, when you concentrate on all the space filled with bones, the mind is very calm. It doesn't start getting distracted by thinking what's for lunch or, you know, what did somebody say to me that I don't like. None of those things seem very important when you think that what's sitting there actually is a skeleton. It's you. Okay? So the mind gets very calm, you know? It's easy. I find it much easier to concentrate. Okay, so then it's very large, filling all of space. Then it starts to contract again. Okay? And it comes down to normal size. At that point, the flesh starts to reappear on it. Okay? So then you imagine your flesh starts reappearing and it goes halfway up your legs and then it kind of comes up to your waist and then it comes up to your body. So all your muscle and skin and inner tissues are coming. And then the flesh all appears, you know, up here around your head. And then at the end, only the top of your skull is exposed. Only that's the bone. So all the other tissue has come back, but the top of your skull is exposed. Okay? Do that. It's an incredible meditation. I mean, I'd like to discuss with you to see if you have the same sensation that I have. Because for me, you know, imagining all the flesh coming back on, yes, that's exactly it. It's disgusting. It just seems so disgusting. And yet, this is the body that we're so attached to. And when we thought of the flesh going away to reveal the skeleton, we felt, ooh, how awful. No, I want to hang on to my flesh and my internal organs. But then once you're the skeleton and all this stuff is coming back, it just seems so putrid. And this is what we're walking around with all day. Isn't it? I mean, you look horrified, but this is true. I'm not lying, am I? No. We're just so ignorant that we see this body as, you know, some kind of great, fantastic thing to be attached to. But I'm just telling you what it is. Yeah? You did lots of dissections, you know. Yeah?
It was a very strange thing.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's the second step, according to one way. And if you do it that way, the second step, then the third step is you do the same way. You know, your body and the flesh and the organs dissolve and the bones get very big and then you concentrate on the universe filled with the bones. And then the body comes back to normal size. And then all the flesh reappears, except this time on the third step, you know, it starts with the legs and goes up and all your internal organs and all this stuff. And now instead of just leaving the skull exposed, it comes back everywhere except for the little hole right here where you started out with, the little space in your midbrow, and you concentrate on that midbrow space at that point. Okay? So that's one way to do steps 2 and 3. Another way to do step 2 and 3, okay, is again, you started out the same, the tissue and everything falls away and it gets big, and then it comes down and it becomes smaller and to normal size. And this time, the skeleton starts dissolving. And so the skeleton just is dissolving. All the bones are just disappearing, you know, from your legs and your thigh bones and your pelvic bones and, you know, your backbone and your ribs and your neck and your jaw. And everything dissolves except the upper part of your head. So just the top part of your cranium remains. Okay? And, yeah. And so we concentrate on just the top part of our cranium. That's all there is. Okay? So when you're doing it this way, you're not imagining the flesh reappearing on your body. Okay? Just the bones are dissolving, and then there's just the top part of your cranium sitting there. Yeah. When I was in Thailand, and they took us to see an autopsy, because that's what the monks often do, and I had asked to do that. It was so interesting. When we got in there, one of the first things they did in the autopsy is they have this thing that's a little spinning wheel, you know, maybe like the grinder in the the shop, this little spinning wheel, and they just went like this around the guy's head, you know, and then just went boop, you know, and the top of his cranium came off, and then, you know, then they went boop, and his brains came out. Yeah, before they cut that first they cut here and pulled the skin back and the hair back, because they have to put the body together again afterwards. Okay, so they pulled that back, then took the cranium off. Then after they got done with the autopsy, they threw everything just back in. It didn't matter where it came out of. You know, they just threw it all back into the middle, stitched it up, put newspaper in the skull, put the top of the cranium in, and then pulled, you know, this part that was back with the scalp, pulled it over here like that, and then stitched like that. Then it was ready to be buried. It was really, you know, I had somehow thought they would put everything back where it belonged. You know?
Nice and tidy.
Yeah, it was nice and tidy. I mean, I was raised to put things back where they belong. But when you're doing an autopsy, that rule doesn't hold. They just threw everything into the gut, sewed it up, and stuffed the head with the newspaper. Yeah? Okay. So that's step 2, if you're doing it this alternative way. Yeah? So just, you meditate at the end just on the bone remaining of the crown of the head. None of the flesh has reappeared. In that case, then, when you do step 3, okay, you know, you do the same thing. Everything gets, the tissue falls away, the skeleton gets big, then the skeleton comes down to normal size, all the bone dissolves upward, and this time everything dissolves until there's only one little piece of bone remaining here in the midbrow, and you concentrate on that little fragment of bone, and that becomes your object for single-pointedness. Okay? So this... these meditations on the corpse and the skeleton, they're antidotes to all forms of desire. They don't eliminate the root cause of desire, okay, because the ignorance grasping true existence is there. But since it's very hard for us to eliminate that root cause, we don't really understand emptiness very well, then doing this meditation is a very specific meditation to stop the the desire. Okay, and so it becomes very clear, you know, when you're sitting there focusing on the universe filled with bones or on your own body as a skeleton, then the question naturally appears to the mind of what in the world is there to desire in this body? You know, what is so beautiful about a pile of bones? What is it that we think is so gorgeous, you know, that we want to touch and hold and fondle the body, and we, or even that we want to have a body again and again and again? You know, it's just, yeah, either the materials that make up a corpse or, you know, bones, skeleton. Okay. The only way to determine whether these meditations work is to do them. So you have to sit down and do them. It's one thing to listen to them and watch your mind be reactive. It's a whole other thing to do them. And if you do them over a period of time, not just once or twice, but, you know, do them and see how it changes your attitude, you know, because these meditations are also designed to help us develop renunciation from cyclic existence. And we all know that renunciation is the foundation of anything. If we don't have renunciation, we don't have any desire to really change anything, because we think cyclic existence is a pleasure grove. Yeah, but if we see that cyclic existence means being tied to a body like this under the power of afflictions and karma, then that helps us really develop renunciation. Okay, so these meditations are not very appealing ones to people who are reluctant to meditate on the uncleanliness of the body. Okay, so if you don't want to see the body as it actually is, then you're not going to like these meditations. But this meditation has many advantages. Okay, so here are the perks that come. Yeah. So, first of all, meditating on the ugly aspect or the undesirable aspect of something, anything, cuts down our attachment to it. So it cuts down the excitement that fantasizes about receiving pleasure from this. And as we know, when you're trying to develop concentration, excitement is one of the big hindrances to developing concentration. Yeah? So excitement, sensual desire, all of these get reduced very dramatically by doing these meditations on the body, because the body, they make the energy of the mind lower, the mind becomes more sober, yeah, more realistic, and so then it doesn't become so flighty and scattered and going from one object to the other. Yeah. So that's why I said, you know, when I do the meditation on bones, it's much easier to focus. Okay. A second benefit of doing this is, as we make the focal point of our meditation subtler and subtler, you know, it starts out being this huge skeleton and then contracts, and then in the second wave for steps 2 and 3, then it becomes, you know, just the top part of the cranium, then it becomes just the little bit of bone at the midbrow. By making the focal object of our meditation smaller, that eliminates laxity. And so laxity is the other big, you know, hindrance in our meditation, or big fault in our meditation. So you can see that this meditation on the skeleton helps to reduce excitement and helps to reduce laxity. So, you know, therefore it's very helpful for increasing our concentration and for increasing the clarity of our visualization and the intensity of the clarity of our visualization. A third benefit is that it actually helps us to develop single-pointedness on our chosen object of meditation. Yeah, so we eliminate excitement, we eliminate laxity, then very easy, you know, much easier to develop responsiveness and single-pointedness. So at present, we think of our body as something that is quite stable, don't we? Here's my body, it's stable, it's permanent, it's here today, it's going to be here tomorrow. Yeah, we never think of dying or the body getting destroyed or anything like that. Yeah, even all the people who died today, the people who lost limbs today, none of them this morning when they thought, when they woke up, thought that would happen. Yeah, but so we think of our body as stable, and we think of it as firm. We think that it has an essence. There's something really in this body that is an essence. We think our body is clean and beautiful and attractive, you know, and worthy of being desired. Yeah. We think our body belongs to a real me. And yet when we do this meditation, what we discover is the opposite. We see the body is unstable, changing. We see that it's not clean. It's rather putrid. We see that it's not pleasurable. It's rather disagreeable. You know, that it's in the nature of dukkha. It's unsatisfactory. And we also see it lacks an essence. You know, you dissolve all the tissues and there's only bones there. And what's the essence of this body that we're so attached to? You know, you look down and there's only bones. We say, my body, but, you know, what's the essence of this body? So it changes our whole way of looking at our body and relating to our body. So you can see here that it helps us develop an understanding. This meditation helps us develop an understanding of impermanence, yeah, of the body as being a foul, of it being in the nature of dukkha, or unsatisfactory, and of it lacking an essence. And so, the you know, understanding those helps us understand the four aspects of the First Noble Truth: impermanence, the nature of suffering, empty and selfless. Okay? So it's very effective for helping us to understand the First Noble Truth. That's why the establishment of mindfulness on the body is related to understanding the truth of dukkha. Okay? So this meditation very much changes our usual attitude. It decreases our attachment towards our body. And it helps our Dharma practice, and it also solves a lot of problems and complications in our life. All the problems people have from love affairs get canceled out by this meditation. Yeah. People have a lot of problems from love affairs, don't they? Don't you think so? I mean, that's what they write so many movies about, all these people yelling at each other and throwing things at each other and screaming I love you and then screaming I hate you, and, you know. I mean, if we look around us, so much suffering because of attachment to this body, and this meditation just helps us lessen all of that. So we begin to see that the body by nature is unsatisfactory. It's by nature dukkha. There's nothing in it to cling to. There's nothing in it that is going to bring us ultimate lasting happiness. There's nothing in it to be attached to. Okay? And we begin to see that, you know, this body gives rise to pain due to the slightest little thing happening to it. Yeah? And this is our day-to-day experience, isn't it? And then when we think, I took this body because of afflictions and karma. I took this body because of my ignorance grasping at true existence. And this body is unsatisfactory by nature. Then that gives us, you know, it leads to renunciation of cyclic existence, the determination to be free of cyclic existence, and it gives us a lot of oomph to want to realize emptiness, because the realization of emptiness is what is going to overpower that ignorance that is at the, lies at the root of our cyclic existence. Okay, so this meditation is very good for all of this kind of stuff. Now, one element that's very important here is we should not, from this meditation, we should not start hating our body. So we don't go to the other extreme. Now we think this body is wonderful and fantastic. We should not go to the other extreme and hate our body or hate ourselves. You know, the Buddha is not teaching that. That's unhealthy psychologically to hate ourselves or hate our body. We just see the body for what it is. Boss, that's it. Okay, don't hate the body. Then we look at the body and we see there's nothing here to be attached to. Yeah, but on the other hand, this body is the basis of my precious human life, and my precious human life gives me the ability to practice the Dharma and to generate the determination to be free, to generate concentration and bodhicitta and wisdom. So if I'm going to practice the Dharma, I have to keep my body healthy. Yeah, I don't neglect my body or hate my body or beat myself up or feel guilty because I have a body. But this body is the basis of my precious human life. I need to keep it healthy so I can practice the Dharma. So in that way, we take care of our health, not out of attachment, but, you know, out of a wish to practice the Dharma. And we keep our body clean, not out of attachment, but because that's part of keeping it healthy. Okay? So in this way, we develop a much healthier relationship with our body than we have now. You know, we see so often with our body that we're so attached to it that any small thing that happens to it, our mind just flies off with some kind of horror story. Yeah? You know, you wake up with some ache and pain and all of a sudden you're going to be paralyzed forever and then you're going to, you know, die from atrophy and it's all going to happen by next Tuesday. You know, because of our, we have so much attachment to our body that we make up all these stories and then get freaked out. Whereas if we have a more honest relationship with what our body is, we see what it is. You know it's not going to last forever. We know it's going to decay and die sometime. But right now, we keep it as healthy as we can, and we use it to practice the Dharma instead of using this body for, you know, just getting pleasure. Because, and it's not that pleasure is bad, but pleasure in the end doesn't bring any satisfaction. I mean, Mick Jagger really had it right. And, you know, because pleasure, no matter whether it's the pleasure of, you know, winning the football tournament or the pleasure of getting appointed to a position you've always wanted or the pleasure of pleasing the body, none of that pleasure, none of that happiness lasts for a long time. And we're always right back where we started at. Yeah? So, you know, when we want to get out of samsara, then we're looking for a longer lasting kind of happiness that's based on reality, that's based on, you know, truth and understanding, not that's based on craving and attachment. Okay? So this meditation, you know, we stay very attentive so that we come out of it with a more realistic view of our body. Don't go to the extreme of hating the body, but don't go to the extreme of indulging the body either, because it's not going to get us anything in the long term. Okay? So hearers and solitary realizers, those beings who are aiming for their own liberation for samsara, they meditate on their own body for the purpose of liberating themselves. Bodhisattvas, which is the path that we're aspiring to practice, meditate on the bodies of all sentient beings so that we can develop an awareness of the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of the lives of all sentient beings, and that awareness of their dukkha, of their misery, increases our compassion, which increases our bodhicitta, which motivates us to realize emptiness and become a fully enlightened Buddha. Okay? So the difference here in between how the hearers and arhats meditate on it and how the bodhisattvas do, and it's dependent on the motivation. Okay, so again, meditating, what we just did on the body there, that's meditating on the specific characteristics of the body, and examining the common characteristics is meditating on the impermanence, suffering nature, and selflessness of the body. Okay, so there's some other meditations on the establishment of mindfulness of the body. We did this a couple of years ago in retreat, where we went through the 32 parts of the body. For some reason, I don't know why, Gyalo Trukhi Gyaltsen doesn't describe this in this text, but it's very clear in the sutras, in the Pali Canon, talking about that. So if you want, we can go through that. We did it in a lot of depth a few years ago. We took out all the picture books about the body and assigned everybody different organs to look at. But it's very helpful. So let's pause right now and see if you have any questions so far about mindfulness of the body, what we've done so far. Okay. We'll do this meditation in the upcoming week, okay? So we'll move on now to the establishment of mindfulness on feelings. Feelings is our second object here. And in our root text, it simply says, feelings have the nature of experience. So when we talk about the five aggregates, when we talk about a person, you know, a person is merely labeled in dependence upon the body and mind. So the body is one aggregate. That's what we just got done meditating on. The mind can be divided into four aggregates. Aggregate means like a heap, you know, a collection of factors. So those four aggregates that form the mind are feeling, discrimination, conditioned factors, and consciousness. So right now we're going to look at that second aggregate, feeling. And it's pinpointed out here. Feeling is actually a mental factor. We have many, 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 many mental factors. But, all the other mental... Well, feeling and discrimination are pulled out when we talk of the five aggregates. Two mental factors that become their own aggregates, while all the other mental factors are just lumped into conditioned factors. And that's because feeling and discrimination are very, very important. Here in the four establishments of mindfulness, again, feeling is separated out from all the other mental factors, and it's one of the four establishments, one of the observed objects. When we look at the 12 links of dependent origination, which talk about how we get born in cyclic existence, feeling is one of the links. Yeah. So again and again, in so many different situations, we find feeling is being pulled out and accentuated and emphasized as an object to meditate on because it's important in this way or that way. So what do we mean by feelings here? So we've been doing some of the nonviolent communication training. That definition of feelings, how Marshall Rosenberg speaks of feelings, how we speak of feelings in general in American culture, meaning emotions or something like that, and how the word feeling is being used in a Buddhist sense are very different. Okay? So the term feeling in the Buddhist sense is referring to the nature of experience, and there's three basic experiences. Pleasure or happiness, unpleasant or pain, suffering, and the third one is neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. So when we talk about feelings in a Buddhist sense, we're talking about those three. There's just three of them. Okay. Of course, they can be subdivided because we can have physical pleasure, pain and neutral feelings. We can have mental pleasure, pain, and neutral feelings. Okay? So it's good to start looking at these different feelings we have, because so much of our life is operated, is dependent on our reactions to pleasure, to happiness, suffering, and neutral. Pleasure, pain, and neutral. Yeah. Our whole life is run by these feelings. And we're so, we respond so immediately to these three feelings. And it's so quick that often we can't even tell that there's a feeling and a response to the feeling. We think they're completely merged together. Whenever you experience pleasure or happiness, what's your response to it?
Grasp
at it. I want more. Isn't it? I don't want to be separated from this. I want more. So attachment arises in relationship to pleasurable feelings or happy feelings. And this is physical or mental feelings. Okay? Painful feelings, what arises in reaction to that? Aversion, anger, hatred, dislike, distaste, revulsion. We can't stand it. Okay? Neutral feelings, what arises in reaction to them? Space out ignorance. Okay? So here we have the three feelings, pleasure, pain, neutral, that correlate with what we call the three poisonous attitudes: attachment, anger, aversion, and ignorance or confusion. And there's quite a one-to-one correspondence here. Okay? Those three poisonous attitudes are so called because they are the chief things that motivate our actions. And those actions, especially when they're negative actions, destructive actions, are what throw us into one body or after another, and that karma, those actions, are what influence what we experience in our lives. Okay? So we go from feelings to the three poisonous attitudes to karma to getting reborn. Yeah? And it happens over and over and over and over and over again. So if we look at the 12 links, feeling is link number 7, craving is link number 8. Because craving is our response to feelings. Yeah, when there's a pleasant feeling, we crave for more of it. When there's an unpleasant feeling, we crave to be free of it. When there's a neutral feeling, we just space out and crave for either the neutral feeling never to end, which is kind of analogous for craving for rebirth in the upper realms, the realms of the form and formless gods. Yeah, where neutral feeling is prominent when the higher you get up. Okay? So these feelings are very, very important. And developing, mindfulness on our feelings, really sitting there in our meditation and focusing on the feelings is very interesting, And so you feel the pain in your body, you feel the pleasure, you feel the neutral feelings in your body, and then you watch how quickly the mind reacts. Yeah, my knee hurts. I can't stand it. I've got to move my position. I'm going to be paralyzed forever. Yeah? And so that's why it's very interesting when you do this meditation to focus simply on the feeling, not on our reaction to it, not on the story we tell ourselves about the feeling, but just on the feeling. Okay? And don't try not to let yourself go to that response. Try to see the pleasure for just what pleasure is. instead of instantly letting our mind start spinning out with I want more, I want better, and imagining, you know, how much better it's going to be, and then thinking of everything we have to do to get it, and so on and so forth. Just stay with that. And it's very interesting to ask yourself, why do I call this pleasure? There's some kind of pleasurable feeling in the body. Why do I call this pleasure? What is actually pleasurable about the sensation? Or when you have a painful sensation, stay just on that feeling. Don't go to the story. Okay? Don't go to the reaction. Just stay and experience it. And similarly, investigate what is pain? How do I know I'm experiencing pain? Why do I call this sensation pain? What is painful about this sensation? Yeah. It's really very interesting. Very interesting. And then the same thing about neutral. You know, what is neutral about this? How do I know I'm feeling a neutral feeling? And just watch it. And then watch, especially if you're watching one part of your body, watch how it starts out with one feeling and then it'll switch to another feeling and another feeling and another feeling. You know, how much the different feelings change. Also in the day, look at your mental feelings. Look at all the different mental feelings that come up. Somebody praises you, happy feeling. And again, instead of, oh, I got praised, I must be wonderful, oh, my self-esteem just jumped 10 points. You know, instead of doing that, just look at the pleasant mental feeling and say, why do I call this pleasant? And why do I just immediately go to attachment for it? What is this pleasant feeling? Pleasant mental feeling. Can we even identify a pleasant mental feeling? Yeah, are we tuned in enough to what's going on in our mind to identify our mental happiness, our mental pain, our mental neutral feelings? We're feeling them all the time, but are we even tuned in enough to recognize them when they're going on? Okay. So same with unpleasant mental feelings. You know, watch it. Why do I call this unpleasant? What is it? What caused it? What made it arise? Yeah. Same with neutral mental feelings. Yeah. So this is really fascinating. And this is a way to really get to know ourselves. You know, we always say, I don't know who I am. I'm out of touch with myself. This is the way to really stop and get to know ourselves. And then, especially during the day, to watch, you know, and when you have a pleasant mental feeling, then what does your mind do in response to that pleasant mental feeling? Yeah, do you start tripping out and daydreaming about getting something else and start craving and this and this and this? And when you have an unpleasant mental feeling, you know, somebody said some tiny thing that they didn't even realize you were going to be offended by, but we're really offended and we're in a bad mood. There's so much mental pain after that. Okay? Then what does our mind do when there's an unpleasant mental sensation? I don't like it. I can't stand it. Yeah? I'm going down the hill immediately. That's a reaction. Or to unpleasant physical feelings, gotta take an ibuprofen, gotta take an aspirin, can't endure this feeling. Yeah. So very, very, very interesting to observe, you know, what causes these feelings and what results from these feelings. And to really see how feelings rule our lives. Or how, maybe, well, feelings rule our lives in the sense that our reaction to the feelings just dominate our lives. Yeah? Something happens, there's an unpleasant mental feeling. we make up a story about it. This person did this and that, and they really meant to do this, and they're going to get me, and they're going to harm me, and I'm sure about it, and they're so inconsiderate, and I got to protect myself, and da-da-da-da-da. And that, all that whole story, and then we get really defensive, and then we block other people out, and we feel locked inside of ourselves, even though we really want to connect with other people. And it's all happening because of our reaction to an unpleasant mental feeling. That's all there was an unpleasant mental feeling. And our mind completely spins out about it. Yeah? The same way is, you know, if there's a positive feeling, mental or physical. Yeah? Somebody comes and touches you, and already the mind is, you know, going into all these elaborate visualizations of this, that, and the other thing. Yeah. But really just to look at what is the raw data there, what is the raw feeling, and separate it out from the story, separate it out from the reaction. Okay? So what you're doing there is between link 7 and link 8 and the 12 links, you're cutting it. Yeah, you're experiencing the feeling, but you're not going on to craving. If you don't go on to craving, then you're not going to go on to karma. Yeah, you're not going to go on to rebirth. So that's why that's one of the points in the 12 links where you can cut it. The other point is between ignorance and karma. Yeah. Don't stop the ignorance, and then the ignorance, then the second link, condition factors or karma, karmic formations, then that doesn't get created.
Oh, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe it feels like I experience events that are not quite pleasurable, but not quite neutral either.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for instance, maybe I would be like walking outside, like through the trees or in a meadow, and I would see like a deer run by.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of pleasurable, but then again, it's kind of neutral too.
Mm-hmm.
Like it could leave and I'd be fine, and if it didn't happen, it seemed all
right.
And right. It didn't bother me either way.
Okay.
But it also seemed kind of nice.
Yeah. Okay. So there's things where you have some small pleasure, like you were saying, walking in a meadow and the deer runs by. Okay, so it brings you some small pleasure, but the pleasure it seems like it's almost neutral too, because your mind doesn't necessarily spin out to, you know, I've got to come out here every day at this time to watch for the deer because it brings me so much pleasure to see the deer. Okay, so the thing is, it's a small pleasure, yeah, so we don't necessarily spin out big time about it, but we might notice that deer. And then when we come into our meditation and we sit down and we're trying to concentrate, it's like, oh, that was so lovely seeing that deer, you know? And our mind can go off to, oh, I'd really like to share that experience with somebody else and love seeing that deer. And, oh, the grass was such a beautiful color. And, you know, the mind can still get attached to it later, remembering it. But just because, you know, when I say we spin out, there I'm talking about where it's, you know, a stronger pleasure, so there's stronger attachment. Okay? That makes some sense to you?
A little.
Okay. Anybody else with questions?
Well, yeah. I have a question about this neutral, you know, the neutral feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Is it like I don't care, or is it just... What is it?
Yeah. What is the neutral feeling? It's like, what's the feeling in your little toe right now? Mm-hmm. You know, you're not paying attention to it. Because
right.
It's not painful, it's not pleasurable. That's neutral. The actual term is not pain, not pleasure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned something about the God realm is connected to that.
Oh, yeah. In the sense that neutral feelings Once you get to the fourth jhana, the fourth meditative stabilization in the form realm, there you're experiencing only neutral feelings, and also in the formless realm, only neutral feelings. And so, you know, having some kind of confusion about neutral feelings can lead to the mind seeking rebirth in one of those God realms.
Is it because those would be confused with pleasure?
Yeah, because in the form realm, there's two mental factors, rapture and bliss, that definitely go on the side of pleasure. But there's also a certain edge to them. Yeah, that you know how sometimes you can experience a lot of bliss and it leaves this agitation in you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So as you go through the levels of developing concentration, you eliminate the rapture, then you release the bliss, and then in the fourth meditative stabilization, you have only neutral feelings instead of pleasurable feelings.
So why would confusion be when you're there in the fourth state?
Confusion is another translation for ignorance in this term, sense, in that you don't know the nature of reality. You're confused about the nature of reality. So you get attached to this neutral feeling. You seek rebirth in a God realm, in one of the, like the, in the fourth meditative stabilization or in the formless realm, but you're still in samsara.
Right.
Okay, so you're ignorant about the nature of that feeling, and so it leads to rebirth in samsara. Okay. Yeah.
Are many feelings occurring simultaneously?
Are what?
Do many feelings occur simultaneously?
Do many feelings occur simultaneously? They say that we can have one consciousness of any of our six senses at one time, so we can hear and see at the same time. And each perception or each cognition has the mental factor of feeling. So you could have one feeling that's related to what you're hearing, another feeling that's related to what you're seeing, another feeling related to what you're smelling, and those could all happen at the same time. But usually what happens is our mind will pay greater attention to one or the other. Yeah. Okay, so that's it for this week. A lot to think about. Yeah. We'll try it just as you walk around and as we look at each other and think, you know, just see through the skin with your super woman eyes and see the skeleton that's sitting there, you know? Yeah? I mean, we go through those scanners now at the airport that, you know, kind of see right through everything, so you just do that without even having to give the other person x-rays.
Spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losung's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
In the snowy mountain paradise,
Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering, May the precious Bodhi mind not have born arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the ten directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the West Florida.